Produced by Wayne Hall, V.R. Hoisington, Bill Govier, Preston Frazier and Jeffrey Cresselius, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 380. What did they do next? Part 1B, Peter Banks.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 380 of the Yes Music Podcast, Tune Fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself, and please do via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I return to the second part of our exploration of the first Flash album, which features both Peter Banks and Tony Kay. The idea of splitting these episodes in half has worked really well, with several listeners getting in touch to provide not only their views, but also additional information about Peter Banks and Flash. So thank you very much to them. We'll come back to those contributions and that album in a few moments' time. This week on Facebook, the big news was that some early details of the latest Yes release have appeared. Mark and I talk about this in our two pence later in this episode, but we recorded that before seeing these new details, so some of the questions we ask and observations we give are now obsolete, but never mind. It seems that the Yes 50 Live package will consist of either two CDs or four LPs, and the track list is, look away now if you don't want any spoilers, side A, Close to the Edge, side B, Nine Voices, Long Walker, Sweet Dreams and Madrigal, and We Can Fly From Here Part 1. Side C, Soon. Side D, Awaken. Side E, Parallels and Excerpt from the Ancient. Side F, Yours is No Disgrace. Excerpt from George's Song and Mood for a Day. And side G, Roundabout and Starship Trooper. Now, you will have spotted some anomalies there, but I think it looks like a positive collection rather than a rehash of other releases. We'll just have to wait and see. In other news, Preston Frazier has reviewed Man on the Moon from Open Your Eyes, certainly an unusual song, and Daniel Crone talks about Yes remixes. You may also know Jamie Glazer, who was the touring guitarist for the Anderson Ponti Band, and a fabulous musician. He's taking part in a fantastic-sounding new project, and he's posted a preview of it. Here's how he describes it all. He says, "Today I recorded for composer-producer John Verhadje. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was doing an orchestral tribute record of John Anderson songs. This was the first session I used my new Atlantis by Wilcox Guitars. It was wonderful. Great full sound, sustained for days, no hum, no noise, even with the Helix cranked and sitting 2 feet from my JBL monitors. Super happy over here. Solo section, take two, If We Are One." So you really should go and see that video if you haven't seen it already. It's really good. Preston has got hold of a Key Studio CD finally, and the Circa epic Yes medley gets another outing. No reason on earth why not. In the visitor posts, Jeffrey Cottrell showed off his new Miraz Story of I CD, which does indeed look fantastic. And Jeffrey Mason shared Light Freedom Revival's latest news. And this is another piece of news involving John Verhadje. So here's what it's all about. Light Freedom Revival continues its musical journey by envisaging the unique single Wildest Dreams, a cover of the song with the same name by Taylor Swift. Canadian singer John Verhadje is teaming up with Billy Sherwood, Oliver Wakeman and Dylan Howe to create an impressive take on modern pop by extending ideas using familiar prog sounds. And here's a quote. "I wanted an arrangement that would merge the Yes universe with the Taylor Swift universe, in the spirit of how Yes arranged America, but with the fun style of Taylor." So to my ears, the music does sound as odd as the concept appears to be. It could grow on me, though, and the performances certainly are superb. Jeffrey also posted a link to a talk by Chris Moore, who did, amongst many other things, the No Earthly Connection cover for Rick Wakeman. Over on Twitter, I perhaps unwisely reminded everyone that I've been learning the bass guitar specifically to take part in this year's Play for Chris video, organised by the wonderful Miguel Falcao. Head over to miguelbass.com for your chance to get involved with that. There are a lot of Thousand Hands promotional tweets, and Simon Barrow and Dave Watkinson both shared the Trevor Horn breakdown of Owner of a Lonely Heart, which is well worth a watch. As always, thank you to everyone who got in touch this week in any way, including those who commented on last week's episode. I'll refer to them in a moment.
I put on Yes Music Podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I put on Yes Music Podcast every week. what Kevin says.
So several people got in touch about that Flash first album. And the first person was Michael Hanahan. He sent photos of his copy and said, I almost forgot I have a copy of the first Flash album. A radio station I used to DJ for way back in the 80s was closing down, and I managed to talk one of my bosses into letting me have a handful of albums that seemed to catch only my eyes. Thankfully, one of them was Flash. I dare not try to remove the radio station tape for fear of bringing the cover with it. You can see the result in the bottom right corner of the main cover, from separating a misplaced neighbouring album whose tape had stuck to the Flash cover. And incidentally, I've put all his photographs into the show notes for this week. Do go and have a look. He carries on. I included pictures of the album's outer and inner covers and close-ups of the inner cover's notes and both vinyl labels. Note that on the vinyl label for side one, it states that the first song, Small Beginnings, written by Banks and Carter, is from the film Record Review. This isn't noted anywhere else on the album. Peter Banks plays a variety of instruments, and Tony Kaye has his The Yes album kit of organ, piano and ARP synthesizer. Or is that ARP? It is indeed one of the most interesting album covers to come into the Yes-related world, and I find it a much more interesting and pleasant to look at than a certain painful album cover from the 70s. What were they thinking? And then he got back in touch the next day. He says, I found one more tidbit this morning about the Flash album. I have a subscription to Google Play Music, and I noticed that they have the Flash album available for listening or as a download for members. However, I also noticed an expanded edition that is available. It has only one additional track, which is a single version of Small Beginnings that clocks in at 3 minutes and 11 seconds. It's actually a very good, peppy, progressive single. I included three screenshots of the album from my Play Music app. So thank you very much indeed for that. Do go to the show notes, as I say, to have a look. Doug Curran left a fascinating comment on the show notes for last week. He said, for your information, the first thing Peter did after leaving Yes was to join Bloodwind Pig in late 1970, replacing guitarist Mick Abraham. He then did sessions for a record by singer Chris Harwood called Nice to Meet Miss Christine, which I own. Very interesting. With a killer lineup of Banks, Dave Lambert of the Straubs, Ian McDonald of King Crimson, drummer Peter York of the Spencer David Group, and others. The first Flash album did the best commercially with the single Small Beginning, which I own, reaching number 28 on the US Top 40 charts. I highly recommend all the Flash albums for Peter fans, including the live releases, but my favourite and most people's is the first one with Tony Kaye. And as Mark said, Tony was never a member of the band. He just guested as a favour to Peter. Tony confirmed this with me in interviews in the 70s and 80s, as did Peter, who I was friends with for about 30 years. Fantastic stuff. Thank you, Doug. And then Stephen Lamb also chimed in with, I agree with Mark's comments up to a point. I do think it's a progressive rock album, and it also gives an interesting insight into how Yes might have sounded next had Peter and Tony stayed in the band. To put it in perspective, it was recorded 2 months after Fragile was recorded, and in terms of sophistication, it doesn't match it. It probably doesn't intend to. However, in terms of quality, I think Yes are in a different class. I know I'm biased, as we all are, but while I think the first Flash album is pretty decent, I'm not totally surprised that they didn't make it. It's good, but not a lost classic. And then Stephen adds, by the way, and this is an exclusive, I'll be working on a follow-up to my Yes book towards the end of the year, Yes Solo to 1980, which will cover all the solo albums by the band members and its alumni. So that means taking in, for instance, the first 7 Rick Wakeman solo albums, the first 2 by John Anderson, the first 2 by Steve Howe, and, well, everything else released in that time, including, using a little poetic license, the first Flash album. It may squeak into 2019, but I think it's more likely to be early 2020. Right, OK, so we'll very much look forward to reading that book, and thank you very much for that. John Thompson also added, never heard this before, very enjoyable. Sound is a bit dated considering when recorded, but great ideas and enthusiasm. Peter shines throughout, having a lot of fun, really great. I've not seen it on vinyl down under. Wonder if it made it here. I'm not quite sure, John, but thank you for the comment. And then we also had a voicemail from Brady. And here it is.
Yes, this is Brady from the Midwest of the United States, and I'm a 23-year-old Yes fan and progressive rock fan in general. I recently found out that I believe the latest live recording that Flash put out, of course, you know, Peter Banks' band after Yes, it was released in a couple of years ago, but recorded in 1973 in Kansas City, Missouri, which is pretty strange because that's very close to where I live in the Midwest, and it's strange they wanted to record a concert there out of all places in the United States when they could have done it in a more populated area. But Kansas City is known for its musical background, so that does make sense. And also, I think Flash on their first record had a decent hit with the song Small Beginnings, as it appeared in the movie Record Review. Anyway, it's just interesting stuff. You're a fantastic podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Brady, for recording that and sending it in. So here we have Flash's first album. On bass and backing vocals was Ray Bennett. Drums, cymbals and percussions were Mike Howe. Electric guitar, acoustic guitar, synthesizer, ARP synthesizer and backing vocals were Peter Banks. Lead vocals and percussion was Colin Carter. Lead vocals, rhythm guitar were Ray Bennett on the second track, I think. Organ, piano, synthesizer, ARP synthesizer was Tony Kay. In fine contradictory style, the first song on the self-titled album is called Small Beginnings, but it's actually 9 minutes and 23 seconds long. As mentioned above by Brady, it was a minor hit as a single, as we know, much cut down, perhaps due to the fact it was included on the rather aptly titled film Record Review. The song blasts off with brilliant Banks arpeggiated guitar sequences matched by wonderful Tony K. Hammond. Even the bass sounds rather like a Squire line from the time, so it's a characteristically blistering opening brimming over with energy. Drums and a bit of acoustic guitar have a speedy break before those curlicue patterns return, and then some strong lead singing backed by great vocal harmonies enter. It has flower power and psychedelic overtones, but it's wrapped in rock and progressive elements as well. Sudden hiatus moments make it all much more interesting than it could have been, and the whirling Banks lines remind us very firmly of his Yes live performances. There's even a Squire walking bass shuffle rhythm interlude, and the kind of rising patterns incorporated with Bruford-esque drums which wouldn't have been out of place in a third Yes album had Banks stayed. It's not Yes, and not least because of the non-Anderson vocals, but there are clear echoes of what Banks brought to the party, and of course Kay's input is very clear. After 5.5 minutes, a calmer mood is thrust upon the listener, which is once again reminiscent of moments on the first two Yes albums, and makes the listener wonder about the amount of input Banks had into the Yes soundscape and early approaches. So apart from the vocals, this is rather like a lost Yes song and a huge treat for me. It continues to experiment with different mode and moods, even branching out into Tommy-era The Who and other styles of the time. It's a triumph for construction and keeps you on the edge of your seat right until the end, with moments of a cappella harmony vocals accompanied by drums, and it careers on to the slightly abrupt end, leaving this listener exhausted in a good way. Wow, what an opening. The second song is Morning Haze, a dreamy acoustic guitar and voice workout with some pleasing backing vocals and a proper Child of Aquarius feel. It's a total contrast to the opener, more at home on a ground sheet at Glastonbury than in an electric and electrifying sweaty London rock club. It's very enjoyable, however, and unlike anything in the Yes catalogue, with a tiny bit of a Kinks vibe. It's possible to drift away into the morning haze, perhaps in California. Lovely stuff with some beautiful floating Yes choir-style layered vocals at the end. The 60s feel is perpetuated at least by the title of the next song, Children of the Universe. Maybe John Anderson was hiding round the corner, doing some kind of subliminal messaging when this was written. However, it's back to the rock style of the band, and they throw in some authentic progressive variations on time and rhythm, which make it all rather more interesting than it might at first appear. The vocals and lyrics are flower-powered again, complete with some chanted repeated words I can't catch. Banks keeps the guitar parts interesting and a bit challenging, with small trips out of the expected tonality. The chorus sections are catchy and are directly contrasted by creative passages of Hammond and firmly placed bass notes. It's impossible not to nod your head, but the Banks influence keeps it all from becoming banal. There's quirkiness which elevates the music into a different class than the pop rock mainstream. It's once again a complex construction, with blasts of fabulous harmony singing and still those weird guitar interjections. Banks gets to throw in a proper guitar solo, and it's a joy to hear the at times strident and powerful, and at times intimate and beautiful Hammond lines from Kay, such an asset to the music. It's here we hear a synth solo for the first time, and it's a fine one, full of early 70s sci-fi tones and fun, but fully integrated into the music, not just thrown randomly on top. In Banks' next solo, you can hear his improvisational approach as he works through the material, treating it in different ways, and always fascinating. Like the first song, this is highly engaging and exciting. There's even a slightly comical false ending, infused with a couple of comedy sounds, which ends up bringing back the original rocking and rolling material. So once again, this is fully progressive in approach, and with a real sense of humour. I'm listening without the benefit of track identification, so I can't really tell where Dreams of Heaven starts, but I don't care, because I'm enjoying it all so much. There's an acoustic guitar solo which seems to be trying out a few different approaches before settling on quite a jazz-influenced mode, and then the rest of the band pile in with a rollicking stamp-your-foot anthemic number. The melodies are mobile and bounce along pleasingly in the more than 12-minute-long epic song. There are interesting time signatures and changes of feel, with some slight touches of King Crimson tonality, lyrical and chordal approach, which I have to say I wasn't expecting. Okay, I'm really lost now, as the former feel is faded out and a new rockier stadium lead vocal exclaimed passage enters, followed by a frenetic jazz club guitar-led passage, which allows Banks to showcase some screeching long-lined electric guitar lines against the tapping light strokes of the drums and the constant quaver-pulsed jazz bass line. It's a mesmerising sonic experience, perhaps meant to invoke or be inspired by a hallucinogenic trip. I read recently in Will Romano's book that Peter Banks and Bill Bruford spent a long time listening to jazz, and maybe that's why Banks has incorporated it here, blending it skillfully and mind-stretchingly into rock as well. Passages of Bernstein-inspired mock Broadway musical vocal chorus work appear, as if from nowhere, and it's now clear that this is an attempt to create some kind of weird tone poem, blending a bewildering acid-tinged collection of different musical styles into a seething but engrossing progressive epic. Wow. It just about manages to stay on the rails, but it does a good job of portraying some of the Banks' live insanity from his Yes days and developing it into something unique, surprising and eclectic. It's perhaps a little bit too esoteric and mind-bending for a general audience, even one used to Yes and King Crimson, but it's a very finely constructed, if bewildering, musical journey with many more twists and turns than can be remembered even with many repeated plays. Finally, there's the relatively modest The Time It Takes. With a jokey count-in and dreamy vocals, this calm song sounds quite like one of the down-tempo King Crimson songs from the era. The theme of the lyrics is appropriately mystical, telling tales of Arthurian splendour in its meandering tones. A bit of a relaxing end to the album and an attractive song with great Hammond sounds and strummed guitar behind what I think is supposed to sound like the sound of waves. We seem to have stepped into the 1972 equivalent of the chill-out zone, and I like it. So overall, I'm very surprised by this album, which I expected to be just hard-rocking, wild band material. It's far more progressive in approach than I realised, and much more interesting for it. It benefits from great playing, not least from the two Yes alumni, and it's a record I'd like to own and listen to quite a bit. eBay, here I come.
Greetings, friends. So this week we're going to be taking a more in-depth look at the first Flash album. As you remember last week, Kevin and I briefly chatted about this album, sort of like an introductory episode in regards to this with the new segment that we're doing called What Did They Do After? So now we're going to take a little bit more detailed look, like I just said. As mentioned earlier, or in the last episode, this very first Flash album has always been one of my favorite records that Peter has done, whether it's Yes or outside of Yes, actually, to be honest with you. Well, the debut Yes album In Time and a Word will always place a very high spot musically for me. I've really learned to appreciate those records a lot more over the years, but there's something much more immediate about the Flash album that I took to. I kind of look at it this way. I've been a big fan of progressive music, whether it's progressive rock or progressive metal, for a very long time. So every once in a while, it's nice to get a record like a Flash album, for example, to kind of take you off the complicated course and steer you down a path of something that's a little bit more simpler, a little bit more to the point, and catchy. I mean, any way you look at it, there are a lot of little elements in this record that still show Peter's love of progressive rock. I mean, there's like three songs on here that are well over the 6 minute mark. Like, I mean, you have Small Beginnings, which is 9.5. You have Children of the Universe, which is 9 minutes. You have Dreams of Heaven, which is 13 minutes. So obviously he has that progressive tendency still in his writing, even after Yes, which, you know, kind of makes you wonder if his departure statement that they made up for him seems a little odd in retrospect, saying that they had differences of opinion as far as music was concerned, which I think is absolutely not true, because as you can see here, he very much could write the kind of music that Yes was doing at that time. Now, with that said, The whole band, I find, is very strong on this record. While they play more straight-ahead rock music, you can tell just by the performances that they put on this record that they're very skilled musicians. I mean, Small Beginnings in itself shows a very strong drummer. The bass playing is very good. And I mean, the tone that Ray Bennett has on his bass sounds very Chris Squire-ish in spots. It's very growly, very upfront in the mix. So again, for people who were into Yes at that time and heard this record, would probably have found some comfort in some of the similarity in tones on this record. Now, getting back to the record itself, there's only 5 songs on this record, like I said, but they are all very strong. And in fact, the first song was strong enough, in fact, to do pretty decently, actually, on the charts. Yeah, so Small Beginnings, in fact, got to number 29 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in 1972. It was also featured in a movie, which probably helped it very much, called Record Review. And on top of that, the single has been on several compilation records. So all these things definitely have helped put that song out to the masses and onto many more people's record players, especially because of the compilation records. Now, speaking as a guitar player, this album definitely has a lot of things about it that appeal to me. His lead guitar work especially is really strong on this record, I find, even right from the very opening notes of Small Beginnings, which always makes me smile when I listen to it, because that whole opening guitar line, that diddly 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 diddly, it almost sounds like, in the late 70s, there was a children's show called Spider-Man that used to be on, it was a cartoon here in Canada, and every time Spider-Man would fall off the building or, you know, in some kind of dire situation where he was falling, they always had that sound effect, like when he was falling. So whenever I heard that now at the beginning here of Small Beginnings, it always makes me chuckle because it makes me think of Spider-Man for some reason. As for the rest of it, I think it's very upbeat. I like that sort of drumming at the beginning with that whole break in between where they had the drums just by themselves. And another thing that I find very strong about this record overall is Colin Carter. His vocals are very good, very strong melodies, very catchy. He has a really good tone of voice, very different from John Anderson. But then again, like I mentioned earlier, it's probably one of the things that I like a lot about this record, because a lot of progressive singers have a tendency to have voices in the higher range and like to sing high, like James LaBrie and, you know, a lot of other singers. You know, there are far too many to list, but there is a tendency to have a higher pitched voice a lot of times when you listen to progressive. It's not all bands, I know that, but there's, you know, that tendency. And to have a singer that has a more rough and rustic voice sometimes is what the doctor orders when you're listening to music. So I really enjoy Colin Carter and his singing on this record. It's really good. Another thing that I really like about this record is Tony Kaye. His organ work has been something that I've always loved about Yes, and it is on this record, you know, quite a bit. And another thing that I find interesting about it here, about this record as well, is that there's some ARP work, an ARP synthesizer, in fact. And one of the things that Yes claimed when they were kicking Tony out of the band was that he was not very happy about the idea of using other sorts of keyboards. And it's interesting that on this album, it seems like Peter has no problem doing it. Although there is also a credit to Peter Banks for the ARP synthesizer as well, so maybe it was him doing it, but this is something that I'm not 100% certain about, because it does mention ARP synthesizer beside Tony Kaye as well. So, but I wouldn't be surprised if he used it. I mean, like he said later on, as the technology improved, he didn't mind using some of these synthesizers, and maybe if the band were asking him to use it on this album, you know, since he was being looked at as sort of a session player at that time, or at least he was thinking that, maybe he had no issue doing it since they wanted him to do it. Looking further on to the album, another song that really sticks out quite a bit for me is Children of the Universe. Another song that is very strong, melodically, musically. I really like this song, and I've always said a sign of a really well-written song is something that'll be stuck in your head long, long after you've taken the record off. I mean, I can still hear the melody in my head now for Children of the Universe. So that just goes to show how strong the writing of this record is. Now, another thing that's not been mentioned very often, in fact, I don't think I've even mentioned it in my prior discussions about Flash, is that the sound of this album overall, I think, is fantastic. I would say that I think it's on par, maybe even a little bit better than the Yes album, as I hide behind a sofa awaiting an egg or two to be thrown. I say that mainly because I take a look at the credits, and of course, you know, listening to it, of course, is what makes you realize if you like something or not. And I've always loved the tone of this record. The drums sound good, the guitars sound good. And then, of course, when I look through the credits and I see the name Martin Birch for engineering, it all suddenly makes sense. Martin Birch is one of the greatest sound engineers, I think, in music, period. I mean, he's done Deep Purple records. He did some of the Rainbow albums. He's done Black Sabbath. And I don't mean just any records. I mean, he's done seminal records for these bands. He's done Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow, the debut record. He's done Heaven and Hell for Black Sabbath. He's done Machine Head for Deep Purple. So these are not small records. These are records of some significance. And so to have him working on this album is pretty impressive, to be quite honest. So having Martin work on this record is fantastic. And you can definitely tell that he leaves some of his sonic signatures on this album. Like again, the drums are very good. The guitar tones are strong. And the vocals always sound very good and upfront on his recordings. And I think that's very important too. When you're coming with a debut record out, you always want to come out with as strong a material as you possibly can for an album. And I think the songwriting is there and the production is very much there for this as well. Now, a couple of other things I found very interesting about Flash in this time period is that the band went in November 71 to record the debut. It performed its first gig on January 14th of 72. And exactly 1 year from that time, January 14th, 1973, Flash would fill New York's Philharmonic Hall. So within that time period, obviously, there was quite a bit of hype behind Flash. There was quite a bit of push to them as well. Now, speaking of push, Flash were signed to Sovereign Records, which is a sub-label of Capitol Records. And obviously they received quite a bit of support from them, because as I read here, the record label was hoping that they would be a band that would be on a higher success level, especially in the progressive rock realm, such bands like Yes, obviously, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. The record did fairly well. It sold over 100,000 copies of it. And it says it toured North America a total of 4 times and the continental Europe once. So obviously they had a lot of support from the labels, because back then, a lot of the times, the record labels would have to directly fund these tours, you know, to get them their tour buses, their equipment, and stuff like that. Without the backing of a record label, you're not going to be doing very many tours. And for them to have done 4 tours of America, that definitely shows how much support they had from their record labels. So it's very interesting, the start of this band. And again, I think the record sounding so good and having so many great songs on it gave the record label the sort of confidence that they needed to give them the backing to get out there and to really push this album. So I'm interested to see what Kevin has to say about this record, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it in a lot more detail coming up.
So I've really enjoyed my first experience this week of Flash. And of course, Mark, as we said last week, is a bit of an aficionado of Flash. Perhaps he wouldn't describe himself as such, but anyway, he is here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. So I think this format of how we let you know in advance what we're going to be talking about has worked really well, because we've had several comments in from people. I've already mentioned them in the episode, and a voicemail as well. So that sounds like it's a fantastic way of doing this, and we'll continue to do that when we come back to these types of episodes in the future. But Flash, now, this is fascinating because I found that I was totally wrong in my expectations of this Flash album. So what I was expecting was much more of the earliest Yes approach, so short songs and a lot of Banks' guitar, you know, really blasting everything else away. But I'm wrong about that, because what we found out is that there are longer, more progressive songs in there, very long, so 1 9-minute, 1 12-minute, there's only 5 songs on the entire album, and some of it is very, very complex. Now, I sort of admonished myself, I was annoyed with myself, because of course Peter Banks was very much involved, he was very much one of the 5 members of the group in those earliest days, so his input into Time and a Word, for example, and into those first early really explorative and elaborate cover versions would have been, you know, the equal of anybody else in there. So I had the wrong expectations, but what I did do was really, really enjoy this first Flash record, and I think you did as well, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed it as a guitar player especially. I mean, he does some brilliant, brilliant guitar work on here. Like I said before in my piece, listening mainly to progressive music throughout my day and stuff like that, it's nice every once in a while to come to a record that's not as progressive crazy. Like, it's a little bit more rock put into it. So I kind of enjoyed the kind of switch. I mean, you know, the singing is a little bit more rock and rollish, you know, and I really enjoyed it. I thought that they did a great job, but there's so many elements of the progressive stuff in it. As we both mentioned, you know, there's a hauntingly eerie, close Chris Squire type of bass tone happening in there.
Yeah.
We have lots of Tony Kaye's organ stuff. So there's similarities, but differences.
Absolutely. Yeah. So how much do you feel then that Flash was Peter Banks's sort of vehicle, and how much do you think it was a band of equals?
It's a really good question, actually, because one would think that because of Peter's name and where he came from, you know, I mean, sure, Yes wasn't, you know, huge at that time, but they certainly had a good name going for themselves. And, you know, he was probably the most familiar, I would say, at that point, I would guess, from the other members of the band. So, you know, one would think that it would be a good vehicle for him, and maybe it was his vehicle. But I mean, one would also look at the credits and realize that Peter didn't really have overly too much to do with, you know, he does have a lot to do with the writing, but he's not alone. There's other people involved in the writing, right? You have Colin Carter, you have Ray Bennett involved in a lot of the songs. So, you know, I think it's a band effort. I mean, it definitely sounds that way. It's not like anybody's kind of sounding like they're being put to the side and it's just Peter out there flashing away with everything, no pun intended. but, you know, he definitely, you know, shows his skill, but so does everybody else. I think it's a pretty equal effort.
Yeah, I think so as well. And it's interesting, I read something about when they went to tour Australia, and they, I think, re-released the first album or something like that in Australia. I can't remember the exact details of it, but they were, fascinatingly, when you compare it with the recent Yes events, they were billed as Flash featuring Peter Banks. And the band were very, very upset about this, including Banks himself. And I think that gives us a clue that it was always meant to be a full, equal band and not a vehicle of Peter Banks's. And that was because, again, there was another band, I think, in Australia who were called Flash. So that was to keep the lawyers happy, I think. But yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it is progressive, and perhaps you can see in it some of the arrangement that he liked doing with those early Yes numbers. And particularly, I think there was an attempt to capture his more improvisational style, particularly in some of the songs where he goes off on long solos or whatever and perhaps shifts the tonality slightly from what you would expect it to be. And so it does fit into that sort of progressive realm. But as you say, perhaps it's got a bit of a harder edge. And if you compare it with something like Fragile, which wasn't that long after this album was released, very different. Not the classical approach. But I was surprised, though, something else. I was surprised to hear that long section of very jazz-style playing. What was it about? In the fourth of the five songs?
Oh, Dreams of Heaven?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting because it's something that's not really expected, I think, when let's say you started listening to this record for the very first time.
Yeah.
When you approach this part of the album, it's definitely not something that you would have expected to pop out of the album. But I mean, you know, if people know of the background of the band Yes, for example, you know, Bill Bruford was pretty heavily into jazz, and so was Peter, apparently.
Yeah.
So that influence obviously now had a way to show itself. So apparently when they were writing this record, he probably wanted to do something like that and you know, show his jazz influence.
Yeah, that's right. So he definitely didn't want to be seen as the rocking out, guitar god, as we always say, on his back playing the guitar, spinning around, etc. That really wasn't what he was trying to portray, I think, with the rest of the members of the band on this album. There was a lot of complexity in it. In fact, I think one of the ways in which something like Fragile has stood the test of time and people go back to it and back to it and back to it is because it's possible quite easily to hang on to the structure in all the songs on Fragile. Here I find it quite, although I enjoyed it immensely, this album, I did find particularly the two long, really long songs quite difficult to get my head round the structure of it. It seemed to be in some ways a bit more random than Yes's approach.
Yeah, it's quite possible. Well, one thing I have to say, though, in defense of Flash, is that I found, though, that songs like Small Beginnings and Children of the Universe had an extremely memorable vocal melody. Like, I can remember that singing days after listening to some of these records, or these songs, excuse me. I can remember those melodies, days and days after the fact, which shows how strong they were. Now, of course, I think that as far as arrangement and structure, Yes definitely has a little bit of a advantage over Flash in that manner. Yeah. But one thing, though, that I mentioned in my piece that I'm going to still stand very tall and defend is I think that the production of this Flash record is excellent. And I really hand that over to Martin Birch. I think that he did a great job with this record. And I will, cautiously say that I think it almost, to me, I prefer this production over the first couple of Yes records.
Yeah,
I think it has a bit more guts to it. It has a little bit more grit. I like the sound of the acoustic guitar better on the Flash record than on the Yes albums. I just think overall the tone of it is better. But I will say this, though. Eddie Offord needs to have his, tip of the hat given to him, because Eddie Offord has one thing over Martin Birch, which I'm pretty sure that he'd even admit, is that Eddie has a great skill of editing tape. As we all know, Yes is one of these bands that never really construct a song fully before they recorded it, especially later on. Yeah. It was a matter of 60 seconds here, a minute 20 here, and let's get the razor blade out and start cutting tape. Let's put this here and that here. Whereas, I get the feeling very much that Flash was a band like, let's just work it out and improvise what we do within it. And that's it. I mean, and that's the one thing that I always found fascinating about a band like Yes over a band like Genesis, for example. Mm-hmm. Genesis always seemed to be a band where they went, especially in the early days, they would work out these long songs like Musical Box and stuff, and then go into the studio and record it. Whereas Yes would go in with a part of an idea, like Close to the Edge, and they would go and record certain sections. And then all of a sudden there'd be something that they'd have to learn after it was created.
Yes, that's right. There are lots of stories, aren't there, of having to listen back to the record once it was in existence to learn the parts so they could play it live, which is a really, really fascinating way around doing it. One thing that I was thinking about Peter Banks was that I wonder if it was down to his personality rather than his musical personality, which meant that he couldn't continue and the other guys weren't happy with him continuing with Yes. Because as we've just said, he had the ability, had the different arrangement ability, but certainly amazing arrangement ability, as you can see on this first Flash record. Until Yes actually got rid of Tony Kaye as well, who's on this record, particularly interesting, and they moved into Fragile when you had Steve Howe and you had Rick Wakeman combining those amazing talents with arrangement and creating these works that they did. Could Peter Banks, had he got on better with the other men in the band, stayed longer, do you think?
I think so. I mean, as I listen to some of these Flash albums and even listen to some of Peter's solo stuff like Two Sides of Peter Banks.
Yeah.
He definitely has the musical ability. There's no question in my mind that he has enough musical knowledge to stand ground with these other guys as well.
Yeah.
I think you pretty much though nailed the nail right on its head, as they say, because I think that Peter is also a very strong individual you know, he's very, you know, could be very pig-headed, maybe, who knows. But, you know, when he wants something, he's not afraid to voice his opinion and say it. And maybe it's one of these things that rubbed people the wrong way, you know. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling John Anderson, who's very, you know, very lighthearted and, you know, he's, but I get the feeling that he seems to be one of those people that, you know, wants his way as well.
Yeah.
Right. So when you have two, like, you know, two rams going at each other, you know, something's got to give, right?
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the things that perhaps was suggested in something else that I read, because I was interested in your point about the success that they did have, and the record companies were pushing them. They had that single which was included on the movie, and they seemed to be going up there, and they're playing to big audiences in the US there, you know, just a year after releasing this. And they looked like they were on the up, but I'm just wondering again, as I say, from what I've read, whether it was personalities again that caused them to implode, because there were certain difficulties, I think, again, within the band, and Banks seems to have been in the middle of that. I could be completely wrong about that, but it seemed to me, reading between the lines of what these reports were saying, that perhaps the friction within the band was one of the main reasons it didn't continue and flourish and get as big as Yes.
You know that saying, Kevin, a lion doesn't change his stripes, right? So it's very possible that what sort of got him removed from Yes popped its head again within Flash, and maybe it caused difficulties. Maybe there wasn't as much difficulties with the members. Maybe, who knows, maybe he butted heads with the record label. Maybe he wasn't happy with certain things. I mean, maybe not at the beginning, because obviously, like we said, they got a lot of support. And, you know, that's something that people maybe don't seem to realize, that at the beginning, back in these days, you know, record labels would normally give out hundreds of thousands of dollars for tour support, you know, for buses, for equipment, for new things like that, and, you know, for tickets to go overseas and stuff like that. This is, you know, labels were paying for it, but of course it came out of their royalties in the end, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, though, without that support, they wouldn't have done very much, and the word wouldn't have spread as quickly. So, but, you know, who knows? Maybe there was something that rubbed Peter the wrong way, and he started, you know, making a bit of a stink about it. Maybe he didn't like some of the way the songs were going when they were writing the next records. Who knows? I mean, this, it would be fantastic if we, you know, could find somebody within, you know, the camp, or somebody who knew them well enough to clarify that. But I'm that's just going from speculation and from what I've read throughout, you know, the years of following Flash.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Doug Curran is someone I think who knew Peter Banks quite well, so perhaps he can add a comment or even record a voicemail for us this week. But certainly I've very, very much enjoyed listening to that Flash record, and I must get myself a copy of it. Yeah, so fantastic. So that's our first member of the band who was the first one to leave. The second member to leave was, of course, Tony Kaye. So when we come back to this, I think we're going to have a break for at least 1 week. But when we come back to this, we will be talking about what Tony Kaye did next after that. And you know, it's nice to have the comment from Doug Curran that I read out earlier, because although Flash is the project that everyone knows about, he didn't go straight into Flash after leaving Yes. So that's exactly why we're doing these episodes in this way, so that we can learn from you and what you know about the band. So do let us know in the show notes for this episode whether you agree or disagree with anything we've said today, whether you agree or disagree about Flash itself and Peter Banks, amazing guitarist that he was. All right. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kaye and Kevin Mulrine.
It's a few weeks since we've done a Two Pence, but we're back now and Mark's with me. Hello again, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin.
So, slightly controversial. Now, Keith Hoisington recently posted in his 50 Years of Yes Facebook page that he has seen an advert on the UK, certainly, version of Amazon.UK, where there is a pre-release item on there now of Yes 50th Live. And there isn't even the cover or anything. And this is something I've mentioned before on the show. The Gottlieb brothers did post on their blog a sort of sliver of the front cover of this forthcoming record. So, slightly controversially, I'm going to say for the Two Pence this week, Yes should not be issuing a 50th anniversary live 2 CD set with Roger Dean artwork. So, What do you think? Here are my points then, Mark, before you weigh in. First of all,
I'm very anxious to hear this.
Yeah, you could argue that this is too late. This should have been done, you know, to coincide properly with the 50th anniversary. We're now 51 years in. We're over 51 years into the band. Why wait so long to get the 50th anniversary out? I'm not saying whether these are my views, incidentally. I'm just being devil's advocate. Secondly, another live album? We've got so many and so many recent ones and so many good ones recently. Do we need another one? We've also already got lots of live compilations. If this is a compilation from various different shows on Yes, the 50th tour, do we need it? And we'll come back in a minute to discuss what we think we would need this record to have in order for it to be worthwhile. But first reactions, Mark.
Wow. My first reaction normally is excitement, because anything that comes out from Yes that's new, I'm definitely interested in it. And I'll go one step a little bit further. The last live album that they put out, which wasn't that long ago, Topographic Drama, was so well done and produced and sounded so fantastic. I know I went and I was just praising it from, you know, beginning to end. So with that said, I'm only expecting more of the same production-wise. And since we know that Billy is going to be at the helm of the mix again, I'm even more excited about that. But I understand your points, because for me, I can't help but admit that I would have been far more excited if the news was that there's some graphic in a pre-order for a new Yes album, studio album, as opposed to a live album. Yes, we've had lots of live albums. We've been inundated with them. Look at how many has been, you know, put out over the last 10 years. There's been so many of them coming out, you know, but, you know, we are Yes fans, and we support our boys. We put the flag into the hill and wave the flag happily that they're releasing stuff. And I would have loved to have it to being a studio record, but will I complain about another live record? No.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, let's go back over those points then that I made. Is it too late?
Okay.
I think it would have been great to get it out a bit earlier. And I understand that there are difficulties with that. You have to do the mixing. You've got to choose the best recordings and so on. And it takes a long time, and that's fair enough. So that's all right. I don't mind too much that it's actually after the end of the 50th year itself. Because, of course, you could argue that they wanted to have the best representation of that 50th year. Another live album, I think it's a bit soon after Topographic Drama, to be honest. But if it's significantly different to Topographic Drama, then that'll be great. Another live album, so yeah, okay. So already have lots of live compilations. Yes, we do. So let's move on to the second part of this then. What would it have to have on this live album to be really worthwhile and for you to get really excited about it, Mark? So for me, I'd like to see some interesting different recordings. So, for example, recordings including the guests. So recordings including Tony Kaye, including Trevor Horn, including Patrick Mraz. Okay, so if we had a lasting recording of those sorts of things, those sorts of events that happened, that would get my vote. So what about for you?
Yeah, I have to totally agree with that, especially about the guest part of it, because if we're celebrating, if this record is supposed to be celebrating the 50th anniversary, then we have to really look at those points that made it a 50th anniversary celebration. We brought in other members. You know, they played material that they were involved with. So those songs need to be there along with their performances, definitely. But also, I think that they need to put in one or two surprises. I mean, sure, there weren't too many surprises on tour, but, you know, maybe having a live version of, you know, 9 voices on a live album would be nice to have. You know what I mean? But, you know, like stuff like that, something that we haven't heard 1,000 times, like, do we need another live version of See No Good People?
I mean,
really, I'm just about ready to put a cheese grater to my forehead if I hear that song one more time live on an album, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that it's a bad song, but we've heard it 1,000 times. Same with Roundabout. And I understand, yes, we have to hear those songs live because not only diehard fans go, sometimes there's, you know, the general public, and those are the songs that they know, right? So I understand that point, but You know, the people who are going to be buying this record, don't kid yourself, they're going to be the diehard Yes fans.
Yeah.
It's not going to be Johnny next door who's going, oh, I'm going to go buy the latest Yes album. You know, he's not going to go and do that, right? So why not just put songs that you know that will get the Yes fans excited? Put on Nine Voices. Maybe put like Survival or something on there that they did live, you know, on the one of the shows, and really get us excited about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, if you think about Topographic Drama itself, that very much was, again, and we keep coming back to this, don't we, the 5% of us who are really deeply into the weeds with Yes, were those were the only people really buying that, weren't they? Topographic Drama with those Topographic Oceans. I mean, it's one of the most reviled records of all time, particularly progressive rock records. So yeah, I think I agree with you entirely. And let's not get upset about this yet, because we don't know what's on the album yet, and it could be exactly what we say could make it exciting. So let's wait and see. Of course, I'll be buying a copy of that when it gets released. Wonderful. Okay, well, again, don't take our word for it. Have your say on the show notes for this episode. What would you like to see in that new 50th anniversary live record? Or do you think it's a waste of time, we shouldn't be doing it at all? Let us know. But for the moment, as I always say, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Coven.
Hello, this is Roger Dean, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Allegedly.
So just before we go, here's the patron update for this week. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Mark Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol-Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, and William Hayes. Continue thanks, of course, to Robert and David. I'll read out the names of the other half next week. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join in by supporting the show financially, and therefore having access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week with a special guest for an interview. But in the meantime, you can follow the show on Twitter, on Facebook or on Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.